Blog Talk Radio.
Monster X Radio. It is September 15th, 2013. I am your host, Johnny Bigfoot, and with me tonight is my co-host, Shane. How you doing,
Hello,
buddy?
Hello, everybody. Hey, everybody. How you doing tonight? Glad to be here, as usual. Should be a great show.
Yeah, and if you don't know who Shane is, he's a Bigfoot researcher out of Oregon. And we got a great guest lined up tonight. I'm very excited for tonight's guest. She is an award-winning newspaper reporter who has appeared on many TV shows and radio shows. And as a journalist, she was the first to break the chilling story of the werewolf-like creature that is said to lurk in farms and the forests of southern Wisconsin. She coined the term the Beast of Bray Road. She's been investigating and interviewing Dog Man and Bigfoot witnesses for over 20 years, and I really admire her for all the work she's done on the subject of cryptozoology. She's truly a pillar of the industry.
Yeah, pioneer.
She's an artist, an investigator. She's the author of many great books surrounding the subject of cryptozoology and monsters. It's an honor to have her here on Monster X Radio. This week, we welcome Linda Godfrey to the show, and now I will give her a call, and we'll get her on the show.
Do this.
You want to try giving her a call, Shane? I'm having trouble here in the studio. I'll get you the number here.
Send me the number and I will give her a call.
Yeah, otherwise you can talk about anything you had exciting.
Oh, I spent
weekend.
Spent the week out at... Well, it's an area near Detroit Lake where there's a lot of sightings, a lot of encounters out there. It's got a history, just a crazy history of some of the best sightings around. And I had, nothing happened the Friday night, just went out there in the middle of nowhere, and nothing big happened. But Saturday night was a little more, or Saturday was a little more interesting, around 2 in the morning, kind of in a rural area. I had a couple wood knocks. I thought maybe were possibly elk, but they seemed to get closer and closer, and I didn't really see any signs of elk out there. I know they're out there, but I really did not see any signs of them. These wood knocks were just, they were pretty loud, and it was an area where there was a sighting back in 2003, I was fishing out there and saw something, but it was a really interesting time. I really enjoyed it. Johnny, I'm having trouble dialing here.
Oh, good old Blog Talk. I'll shoot her a message here on Facebook and see if I can...
Yeah, tell her to call in, but... anyways, I had these wood knocks happen, and I stayed out till, I probably stayed around till about 4:30 in the morning. I was out after 10 o'clock, and I heard after the wood knocks, I heard something crackling on the other side of the river that I was on, and it seemed that I was being tailed, kind of followed, and I wasn't 100% sure, but it was large snaps and breaks. And, the river was rather it was loud. It's a pretty good flowing river. So it was loud. So these breaks, I couldn't distinguish if they were something stepping or snapping from a tree. But I walked probably like a mile. And, as far as I walked, this thing followed me or sounded like it was following me. And I did get a little spooked out because I got to a point where I was kind of cornered by a cliff and the river and I had to backtrack. And it sounded like the sound started coming from my side of the river. And anyways, make a long story short, I didn't see anything, just the sounds. And I made it back to my vehicle after a long hike and whatnot. But, it was another learning experience. I had fun doing it and learned a little something that night. Like I said, I can't say definitely it was Bigfoot, but it traveled, kind of followed me for a long ways. So who knows?
Is that area pretty remote?
No, actually, where I went to was, but where I was actually originally camping at, no. I camped at a campground around Detroit Lake, and then I went from there hiking. So it's not incredibly remote by no means. But the area that I hiked into is pretty desolate and remote, and that's where you get more of your animal encounters and you don't bump into anybody. It's so thick, there's no trail where I was going along this particular part of the river. The one thing I did find was kind of interesting was I found these rocks that were stacked next to the river. They were stacked, and I'll post pictures later, but they were stacked on top of this rock. Could have been human, but the area I was in, it was just, I didn't see any human tracks. I found a couple of deer tracks and whatnot, but it was, the ground was pretty rough, real gravelly, and there's a lot of rocks, so it was hard to distinguish or find tracks. But these rocks were stacked on, and I thought it was kind of odd. Took a couple pictures of that. But it's not extremely remote, but remote enough that I can discount what was following me as human, but I can't discount that it was, not another animal. Just happened to be going along a game trail or something, because there is a load of game trails out there. Good area. Plan going back. It's one of the areas I like to go to a lot, just because it's the amount of history there and sightings. And I go up there and I talk to some of the locals all the time and always try and look for new stories in new areas to see exactly what's going on. But still no luck with the caller, huh?
Is that the same area where you used to have your encounter?
No. If you it's funny, if you look at a topographical map, it's not that far away, but it's the opposite side of the mountain of Mount Hood from where I go to. The area I go to is a lot farther of a drive. It takes a lot of time to get there. It's down some really crazy logging roads to the point where, and then you end up in the middle of nowhere. And the area I traverse to frequently is a hot spot, in my opinion. I can go out there, 5-6 months out of the year, and it's pretty hot. And the other, it's not so much, but that's because of the winter up here. Up there, the roads get snowed in. You can't make it up there. You'd have to snowshoe it in. And I plan on doing some of that, see if I can find any real awesome tracks or anything up there, because it is a hot spot, and I've had many people, tell me of this, encounters in this area. Not quite the same area, but, not that far to travel, I'll tell you that. By land,
nice.
Especially if you're a Bigfoot, yeah.
Lucky for you, you live so close to such good spots, huh?
I really am blessed because I am between Oregon and Washington, and I live that close to Washington that I can make it to Washington and do some squatching up there if I feel so, or if someone tells me to make it there, tell me of an encounter in that area. I try to stay in Oregon, as much as I can. I got a great encounter from somebody down in southern Oregon that is one I'm trying to do here real quick because it's the other end of Oregon for me, so it's, 8-9 hour drive. But it really is a good encounter. This guy, they had seen a Sasquatch his dad had in this camp area, and his dad sat out this backpack, like this hiking backpack, the hard frame one next to a tree, and he put his shoes down next to this tree, and there was a rock there. He remembers this rock being there, a good-sized rock, and the next day or so, the backpack was gone, his shoes were gone, and this rock was gone. And he had no idea, he's in the middle, in a pretty desolate area. He's like, what the heck, where'd all my stuff go? Well, I think within a few days, it showed back up outside his tent. And his shoes did not reappear, but his backpack did. And this rock that was there next to the backpack was there as well. And there was nothing in this pack. There was nothing in this pack. It was completely empty. He's never put food in this pack, so it had no scent for a bear to really pick up interest. There was nothing, no gum wrappers. Bears pick up on the littlest scent. They'll tear your car apart if you have lipstick in there or a gum wrapper. There was nothing like that was ever been in this pack. And it reappeared in front of his tent. The only thing was his shoes weren't there, and this pack was had rip marks on it, like something was trying to get in. You could see, almost nail marks on the pack where it didn't rip through, but you could also see the rips in it where it did penetrate the backpack. And the frame was bent, and this rock was there too, which, you know, if a bear is going to take off of a pack or a cougar, I mean, just whatever is out there, they're not going to put it right in front of your tent, and they're not going to rip it like that. And, I mean, a bear probably would just drop it and left. You know, why put it back in front of this tent? And this is the same area where this guy's had, encounters. And he shared with me a couple other encounters from some other locals. And I've done my research on the area, and it's another hot spot. It's got everything you need to sustain a population of Bigfoot or animals in general. Just the natural resources are ridiculous. So hoping to make it down there to do a little, Bigfooting down there and see what I can find out. And hopefully the air is still fresh and there's some activity there, you know, because it sounds pretty legit. This guy's definitely not pulling my leg. He's well. He knows his animals. You know, he spent some time in Alaska, doing a lot of different things up there, and he knows his animals. So this is a pretty exciting encounter that I've gotten recently that I hope to look into.
So you basically just have to drive an hour or two, at the most, huh? And you're in some serious squash territory.
45 minutes. But if I really want to get into some remote areas, probably an hour to 2 hours. 2 hours would be, 2 hours that I'm in some awesome areas, that most people don't go to or can't go to. Or you'd have to be either a serious backpacker, camper, kind of survivalist or something to get to some of these areas. But I do go to some areas that are not real difficult to get to, but are not traversed that often. You know, you do get your occasional hikers, day hikers out in some of the areas I go to. But all the activity seems to happen, you know, in the evening to early morning. So, you know, they kind of wait for people to disappear before they start doing their thing, coming up to some of the lakes for water possibly, and that sort of thing. Oregon and Washington, Northern California are just some of the most phenomenal areas you can go to. That if you live in the right area, you are a lucky person if Bigfoot's your thing.
Nice.
Yeah.
Heck yeah. Kind of like that.
But it really sounds like Blog Talk's acting up again, huh?
Yeah, I'm going to try calling her on my cell phone, and then I'll have her call in. I sent her a message on Facebook, so I'm going to mute out for a minute here.
Okay. But otherwise than that, you know, here in Oregon, this time of year is usually I find to be, the encounters start kind of leveling out. The hot times in Oregon and some of Washington are usually the late summer months to early winter months. And after that, it kind of levels out and kind of dies down, at least in my opinion, from what I've heard and been researching. So I'm trying to really get out there now because where they go from here, I don't know, but probably the different elevations due to the weather change here in Oregon. We start getting our snow. I mean, it started to rain. You know, I was out in the field and it started to rain, and I was like, okay, probably need to get going because there was thunderstorms in the area. But this is a time of year where kind of dwindles a little bit. There's not as many people out in the woods, obviously. Kids are back in school. There's not as many vacations, so the encounters start dying down. And that doesn't mean that Bigfoot's not around. Just means that there's not people out there as much to witness these things. And that's kind of a good time to go out, in my opinion, because you don't have that human factor. And maybe Sasquatch gets a little more bolder and comes into some of these areas. But here in Oregon, I always find that the money month for me is always August. August is just a killer month. Every single time, just a killer month. You have to deal with mosquitoes from hell. They eat you alive. But if you can get past the mosquitoes and on your tippy toes because, the bears are out and there's cougars around and whatnot, rarely run into them. You have to be on some of the ridges, really, to run into any of them. But, you know, you break past all that, you know, you can if you know your area and you know where to go, you know, I'm not a big believer in habituation, that's for sure. But I do believe there's areas that they frequent, and if you know where those areas are at, and you just go about your business like you're camping. You don't need to do wood knocks or screams or calls and all this stuff. You really don't, because most people, when they go out there, they're not doing that to get these really good encounters, the sightings. They don't. They're just camping or walking along a trail. You know, they really don't need to. You really don't need to go out there and make yourself known. They probably already know you're there, and if they
okay.
want themselves seen, you know,
alrighty.
We'll be seen.
We're ready to go.
Excellent.
Hello, Linda Godfrey. Welcome to Monster X Radio.
Hello, guys. Thanks for having me.
Excellent.
You're welcome. Glad you could join us.
Me too. Me too. Definitely. And it sounds like you're just talking about Bigfoot.
Oh, yes. Yes, that's...
And making
sorry,
yourself,
that's...
And making yourself known to them as if they couldn't detect you.
Exactly. Exactly, yeah. Now, that's kind of my forte. So I was kind of, we had a little blog talk problem here, so I was kind of filling in the time, giving my 2 cents, but we're very grateful and privileged to have you on board the show tonight. We know you have a very busy schedule, and like I said, we're just privileged and honored to have you on the show and talk to you tonight.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Well, why don't you start off by telling us a little bit about how you got started in this whole subject, because I know you've been involved for quite some time now.
Yeah, it's actually going on 21 years altogether, which is really hard to believe. But it all started back right around New Year's between 1991 and 1992. That doesn't even seem possible when I say those numbers. But I was working as a reporter for a newspaper, a countywide weekly newspaper, and really hadn't been writing there very long. I actually joined the newspaper because I wanted to do editorial cartoons for them. And their reporter quit, and they gave me the job because we, you know, got along and everything. So it was really just sort of this weird twist of fate that landed me in this position that when people around my own hometown of Elkhorn started seeing what they called werewolves on this lonely road just outside of Elkhorn, it's about 2 miles long, called Bray Road, that I happened to get the assignment to just check it out. We really didn't think too much of it at first, and I know I laughed. I thought it was funny. And the thing was, I discovered the thing that made it a news story and made it become what it is today was a second little twist of fate, which was that people had not just been talking about this among themselves, but nobody, a lot of them didn't really know that other people had seen it, and they'd been calling our local county animal control officer to report it. So when I happened to know him because I'd been working with him on another story about puppy mills. So it turned out that I discovered he had a manila file folder marked werewolf in his office, an official file folder. Now, when you've got a county official with a file folder marked werewolf full of reports from people who are leaving their addresses and their phone numbers, their contact information, you know, that's news. And it kind of got my attention, too, because I thought, well, people who are just pranking wouldn't be leaving their names and phone numbers, you know, to get investigated for fraud. And there were more of them, you know, than I expected. And when I started talking to them, not only were they a broad range of people, I mean, it wasn't just like, you know, some young guys out for a lark. There were, you know, single moms and elderly farmers and, you know, just this broad spectrum, white collar, blue collar, and it's kind of remained that way to this day. So I thought, well, there must be, you know, something to it. And my line of thinking at the time was that even if it I really did not believe it was going to be an actual werewolf, and I still don't believe in werewolves, not the traditional Hollywood type. It's just sort of a handy catch-all term. But I thought, you know, even if it's just that there's some dangerous large carnivore out there, people really had a right to know about that, you know, to take precautions.
Yeah.
You know, and if it turned out to be no more than folklore, well, how often do you get to see the beginning of, you know, a really good folklore story start? You know, so we decided it was worth running with, and the story appeared. The witnesses all elected to stay anonymous at first, although they later changed their minds. And to our huge surprise, the story went national in like 2 weeks. And Inside Edition came out, and the old sci-fi in Search Of show came out, and I was on radio shows, big radio shows from West Coast to East Coast. There were like a couple of days where I couldn't even take a bath; it was that constant. You know, it was just crazy, and people started contacting me and writing me and saying, they're not alone. You aren't the only ones with this. It's here in Michigan. It's here in the Virgin Islands. It's, you know, my cousin saw it in France when he was in World War II. You know, it's in Tennessee. And it started to dawn on me that this was not just some little local phenomenon, and that it was real, at least at some level, and that it was really a very widespread thing. And this was really before most people had email. You know, the internet was just kind of starting. A lot of people didn't even have home computers. And yet, I was really impressed by the fact that people continued to seek me out, you know, whether they had to use the old landline telephone or write me a snail mail in care of the newspaper. They were finding me and giving me their own reports. And this went on for 10 years. And I didn't really know what to do with these reports at the time. I thought they were interesting and that they should be kept. And I think I wrote maybe four update stories every now and then. You know, I'd get a bunch of them together and I'd write an update for the newspaper. You know, but really during that 10 years, I wrote many, many, many other stories on billions of different topics, you know, and that was really a minor thing. Well, there was another story that had come along about a woman who in the 1920s, she lived in a small Wisconsin town, not very far from where I live, had murdered her husband with strychnine because she had a college-age lover, and the two of them did it, would have got away with it, except they tried to kill her four children, too, and then she became known as the Poison Widow, and it had been completely swept under the rug, and I did research on that for 6 years. So 10 years had gone by, and I had not only that, the Poison Widow, but I really felt that I should be putting all of these reports and speculation and, you know, the things I learned about it, about the Beast of Bray Road and other creatures like it, into a book, too. So I quit the newspaper, and I actually had a little startup news magazine website called CNBC that I started with my friend, and just started writing books. And those first two books came out in 2003. So I haven't really looked back since. But the thing was, once the Beast of Bray Road book came out, the same thing happened all over again. I just got this avalanche of people writing me and saying, yep, me too. We saw it. It's real. You know, and thank God there's somebody who believes me and doesn't think I'm crazy. And that led to the second book on that topic, which was Hunting the American Werewolf. That's the book that the American Werewolf episode of Monster Quest was based on. Upon, actually. And by the way, if anybody watches that show, and because a lot of people still see it, it's still making the rounds,
they should know
it's a good show, you know, but the thing was that you have to realize people who just review that show and then talk about the Beast of Bray Road don't understand that the show mixes in Bigfoot reports with the Dogman reports and doesn't make it clear which are which. And they did that on purpose for a couple of different reasons. But that's why if you get people's descriptions, you know, when they say, well, it weighed 450 pounds and it was eight feet tall, that's a Bigfoot witness talking. You know, they're very, very different than the Dog Man. So, but anyway, that was the second book, and it was twice as thick as The Beast of Bray Road. Same thing happened again. I wrote another one, The Michigan Dog Man, Werewolves, and Other Unknown Canines Across the USA. And then most recently on this topic, I've had a lot of other books, Weird Wisconsin, Weird Michigan. My most recent one then was in 2013 called Real Wolfmen, True Encounters in Modern America, published by Tarcher Penguin. I just finished another one for them that will be coming out in 2014. So it's an unlikely journey, but here I am.
Nice. Yeah, I just got done reading Monsters of Wisconsin.
Oh yeah, I did mention that one. Yep, that one was in there. I did that one in Haunted Wisconsin for Stackpole. So, yeah, that has a pretty good look. Well, and if you read that one, too, you'll realize people think I only research the Dog Man, but I get a lot of other cryptid reports, and I'm sort of an equal opportunity cryptid hunter.
Nice.
And I actually started getting Bigfoot reports right at the very beginning, back in the early 90s. And I would keep them separate and talk about them in my book because I wanted people to realize that people were seeing both kinds of things, that they were really clear when they had a good look as to which one it was that they were seeing. And I thought it was extremely noteworthy, and I still do, that there would be sightings of these two different creatures really pretty close to one another. But I also noticed, because something that I've also done from the very beginning is to map out sightings of where these creatures are. And I realized that they both seem to be coming from an area of state forest that it's actually quite a huge rambling thing that goes from about the middle of, or the northern part of Walworth County, way up north of Milwaukee and west of Milwaukee, called the Kettle Moraine State Forest. I noticed that. I noticed they seemed to be coming out on what looked like foraging loops that would return, you know, back to the state forest. And I noticed that I could almost draw a line and tell you, with a few exceptions, that if you saw something west of this line, it was going to be a Bigfoot, and east it was going to be a Dog Man.
Oh, really?
Which told me that they sort of have separate territories from one another. And I think that, I think that's pretty interesting, and I think it's partly they sort of enjoy the same kind of wooded terrain where there are deer and turkey and, you know, lots of wildlife to chase. So that's why they're near one another. But I'm sure that, like any large predators, they also compete, you know, for the game. And so maybe that's why they have the territories.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like you're saying that they respect these certain territories and that they don't really mingle. I mean, are there any reports where, have you gotten any reports where Bigfoot and Dogman has been sighted together?
Well, you know, it's interesting, not at the same time, but there's one particular area that I've been following for years where Dogman tracks and Bigfoot prints and evidence have been sighted really on the same little area at different times. And I'm talking about full sets of tracks. There was one that I saw about a year and a half ago in a kind of a muddy cornfield where I just stopped and had a look because it's sort of an active area. And they were 6-inch wolf print type tracks. And again, it's really easy to tell the difference between those and Bigfoot tracks because the Dogman tracks look like giant wolf prints. And sometimes you'll see an extra imprint at the end of it that makes the track maybe up to 8 or 9 inches long, and that's actually what would be its heel joint coming down to help it if it springs forward, kind of digging into the ground. It took me a while to figure that out, but that's what it is. But otherwise, they're, you know, they look like canids, and you can see the claw marks, whereas everybody knows what Bigfoot tracks look like.
Yeah.
You know, they're much bigger. They look like, you know, modified human prints. So, but we could see where the wolf-like creature had come out from the bushes. There did not appear to be any forelimb prints, just the rear ones, where it was following deer prints, where it met up and scuffled with the deer. You could see, you know, indentations in the mud. And then you could see, it was kind of funny, it missed that time. You could see the deer prints running to this little woods and the dogman prints heading back over to the brush. So the deer got away. And I've seen other deer dogman print scuffles too. I've got prints of, I had some much better ones in mud near South Milwaukee, believe it or not.
Wow.
Kind of near the Lake Michigan shoreline, where there are cornfields and a little wild area.
Interesting area there. I mean, I know you say there's sightings all over the world or America, but they seem to focus on that southern Wisconsin and Michigan. What, in your opinion, makes this area so conducive for these type of sightings, you think? I'm familiar with that area as well. I've been
Are
there
you?
A number of times. Not for dog man hunting, but, I live in Minnesota, so
yeah.
I've been down that way several times. And it's, you know, it's got woods, but it's a lot of farms and lakes and things.
Well,
and
I think that the Great Lakes are a big draw for some reason. If I've got a map in my Real Wolfman book, the most recently updated map that just kind of shows general concentrations, and you can see this cluster all around the southern side of the Great Lakes, stretching from northern Minnesota all the way up to New York State. They do seem to be more heavily concentrated in Wisconsin and Michigan. I'm not sure whether that actually reflects a larger population of these creatures or the fact that I'm better known and people know more to report to me. You know, I have a feeling I really only get the very tip of the iceberg of sightings. I think the vast majority go unreported, either because people are intimidated or they want to deny it or they're afraid they'll be made fun of or they simply don't know that somebody's been sitting here collecting these reports for 21 years. And oftentimes people will send me reports that are 8, 9, 10 years old and say, I didn't know you were there. I didn't know I could send these to anybody, you know, that was, you know, collecting the data and trying to figure something out about them. And I'm just glad to send them again to somebody who doesn't think I'm crazy. So it's really hard to sort out those factors of whether it's, you know, my presence and being known for it or that there really, really are more of these creatures here. But I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that these sightings seem to have come about at around the same time, as near as I can tell, as the deer population started returning and getting larger. And the wild turkey population, too, you know, is a success story. They were nearly gone. And actually, the Kettle Moraine State Forest is one of the places that was chosen to reintroduce the wild turkeys as a protected breeding species, and it's been wildly successful. There's huge herds of them around. Lots of other game, too, you know, as well. And I think these areas are very well watered. Water seems to be a common factor. There's always water around of some kind. Michigan and Wisconsin both are very, very fortunate in that respect. And I have to say, too, that the sightings are definitely more common east of the Mississippi than west, although I've been getting more and more from California, Texas, Oklahoma, those states, kind of surprisingly. So I don't know, you know, and of course the eastern half of the United States is a little bit more arboreal or, you know, tree-filled, lots of forests. Kentucky is another state that seems to have a lot of sightings, and, you know, you can just imagine the woods of Kentucky, you know, what those places could conceal. But the thing about the dogs, Yeah, it's amazing. Bart Nunnally has done a good job detailing the dogmen and wolfmen that have been reported around Kentucky. So the thing is, I do think that because these people also have some mistaken impression that they're always walking on their hind legs, and that's not true. A lot of people, many, many witnesses, will either see them at first they're crouching or walking on all fours, and then they rise up and chase the person or the car on their hind legs or vice versa. So they can get around either way, whichever is more usual. And when they're on their all fours, you see them, and you just say, wow, that's a really weird-looking, huge, creepy dog thing. You know, that's what people mostly will call it. And I do get a number of reports where I think there's a good chance that what they were seeing was one of these creatures, but you can't really prove it until they stand upright, of course. But it enables them, my point is, it enables them to get around a lot of places with a lot less attention from people because they can, you know, cross roads quickly, they can neighborhoods, and again, you just think that it's some kind of weird big dog. You don't go and report that there's an upright wolf creature.
Yeah, well, speaking of, like, getting around, you mentioned a lot of the clusters or cluster sightings around the Great Lakes. I mean, how many reports do you get of them being in the water or swimming as far as, you know, possibly a transportation or I don't know what?
Not really many. There's an old loggers legend about some loggers in Michigan that were in a canoe and a dog man came paddling up to them. But the only one that I have where it was really in the water was this guy who was jigger pole fishing down in Alabama, kind of near Selma on a river. And he was out in this little flatboat, not very far from shore with his pit bull. And one of these creatures was watching them from the shoreline, and the dog started barking and growling. And so this 7-foot-tall, upright, wolf-like creature started right down the bank charging for him and the dog and started coming right into the water. So it evidently wasn't afraid of getting into the water. You know, it didn't have a fear of that. And the guy had a semi-automatic pistol with him and shot it point-blank a bunch of times. And it just ran back up into the woods. So, and that's an interesting thing that's been repeated. I know the same thing happens with shooting Bigfoot. And I do not advocate shooting either one by any means. But people who have been in that position and felt threatened and have tried to shoot it in self-defense, it will often deter the creature. You know, it runs away, but it doesn't knock it down. They don't see blood. And I've been getting more and more of these recently. In fact, I've got a kind of a little separate chapter heading on it in my latest book that I just wrote that's coming out because I think it's just very interesting. And it's not just bullets. There was the story I had in one of my first books about this family. I'm sorry, I can't remember if it was Colombia or Mexico, one of those countries, and there was a family celebration. And there they call it the Lobizon. You know, it's a different name, but the same creature. Mm-hmm. And it was attacking a little boy that had gone outside of the house while the rest of the family was inside having a celebration. It was a whole bunch of people. It wasn't just the usual small family. And he's screaming. So they all ran out with, they didn't have gardens. They had like garden utensils. They had, you know, hoes and spades and shovels and were able to kind of beat the thing senseless. And they were sure it was dead. And they went back in the house to kind of left it out there to decide what to do with it. They're trying to call the local police. And by the time they looked back out, it was gone. They kind of saw it running away in the distance. You know, so it seems to have this sort of weird invincibility factor. You know, it's almost like, is it growing a bulletproof vest under that fur? You know, or it's the same with the Bigfoot. You know, they appear to be flesh and blood. They leave prints. They seem to need protein. You know, they leave hair fragments sometimes. People who see them most of the time believe that they were flesh and blood animals, and they don't normally do anything overtly supernatural. I do get a few of those, but
yeah.
Probably 95% of the reports don't report anything like a green glow or flying or. You know, once in a while I'll get a very small handful of ones that claim that they were morphing. One morphing from a Bigfoot to a dog creature, by the way.
Kind of like a skinwalker.
Yeah. I tend to put those, or there are some where the physique seems more overtly human with, you know, real actual shoulders. Canines don't have real shoulders. They've got, when they stand up, you see their upper forelimb muscles, and it looks sort of like shoulders, but it's not the same thing as the brachiating shoulders that great apes have. And so that's a very, they have a very, very different physiology. But when I get one that sounds like the body is really very human-like, they're saying that it had knees and it's flat-footed and has big shoulders, then I think there's something else going on. And I don't, you know, I don't rule anything out like skinwalkers or, you know, some sort of interdimensional creature or like Nick Redfern and some other researchers think more and more that it's some sort of Earth, quote-unquote, manifest in different forms, which explains why sometimes you see balls of light or lightning or, you know, sort of electromagnetic phenomena just before or along with the sightings. So, but those are the really small minority. You know, the huge, huge majority describes something that has a long muzzle, fangs, pointed ears on top of the head, you know, canine forelimbs that are held. They'll describe it as like a T-Rex or like your dog when it sits and begs for a bone. Although it can hold things in its forelimbs and its paws are elongated, that seems to be the only thing. But they'll also say, you know, that they're very clear that it's walking on its toe pads, not flat-footed like a Bigfoot, and that it has the canine leg structure where they're expecting to see a knee. They're seeing like the heel and ankle joint bending backwards. So they'll often say, well, you know, its legs were bent backwards, and that I know they're not talking about a Bigfoot. So it's a really, and often they see the tail if they get to see the, you know, its rear side. So it's really, really different than the Bigfoot.
Are you familiar with, I'm sure you are, the Bisa Seven Chutes?
Yes.
Yes. See, looking at that picture, you know, I don't know if it's legit or not, but it looks very baboon-like. And, you know, I've talked to a lot of people who consider the Dogman to be baboon-like, you know, with its features and its behavior, especially around water and stuff like that. In your opinion, is there any correlation there that it could be some sort of like large baboon or something like that?
No, I don't think so. You know, baboons are not bipedal. They don't walk upright on their hind legs. They will sit upright. You know, you'll see a bunch of baboons and they're all sitting upright on the rocks, you know, regarding you very closely. But they have a different facial structure. They have really unusual rumps that if you saw them retreating, you know, you'd know this was not a wolf or a dog or anything like that. And they kind of, if you could, you can Google them or look on YouTube and get little videos of them moving, and you'll see that they really look nothing like what people describe when they're seeing the dog man. You know, and the Beast of Seven Chutes photo, I think, is interesting, but it's really almost impossible to tell exactly what it is with any degree of certainty.
Right.
A lot of it is shadow. There's pixelation. You know, it looks like it's holding this little white, maybe a dog or something. But interestingly, I have had somebody, and I think that I mentioned this in the Monsters of Wisconsin, but I actually went back and did re-interviewed and did more investigation just to be certain about it and wrote again about it in my new book because it's sort of unusual, where two people had a very good, long, slow daylight look at a definite Bigfoot that was kind of playing statue near a mailbox. It was right next to the road, and they rode right past it within feet of it. And it was sitting, not sitting, it was sort of in a crouched, kneeling position. So it was actually right, even with their car, too. It wasn't like way above them. It had its long arms stretched out sort of in what they described as a pleading position, and it was holding a dead white dog.
Yeah.
And they felt that it looked sad that the dog was, that was their impression. But they also said the man watched it, and he could see the whites of its eyes. You know, it had, he said it had very, very human-like eyes and dark, big, big round dark pupils, but he could see the sclera or the whites around it. And he said as he drove past, that was the only part of it that moved. He could see the eyeballs following him as he slowly drove past it, holding it, as it held this dog out. And they went a little ways, and his girlfriend that was with him wanted him to turn back around, and he wouldn't do it. He was too freaked out by it. But they both saw it very, very clearly at close range in the daytime and smelled it. And, you know, he actually accused his girlfriend of passing gas.
Oh, no.
From the smell, which is probably why they aren't dating anymore.
Interesting.
Yeah, so the one instance that I do have out of all these, you know, many years of reports, it's a Bigfoot, you know, holding the dog like that. So, you know, to my mind, if that is a real animal depicted in that photograph, it's just as likely or more likely to be a Bigfoot than a dog man. But you can't tell for sure from it about any of them.
I mean, a lot of people will say that these dog men, could they be misidentifications of bears or wolves?
Right.
But they don't have bears and wolves in southern Wisconsin, do they?
They do go through here. We have everything go through. Yeah, we do. I know from the DNR that there was a bear in the county within the past year. If they saw an acknowledged one, there were probably five.
Interesting.
We've had mountain lions go through here, identified by DNA. And, in fact, if you recall, a few years ago, there was one that was shot near downtown Chicago. That was the one that came right through here. It happened to have passed through a friend's farm. And it had the same DNA as the one that was killed in Chicago. We do have gray wolves or timber wolves passing through occasionally too. I've had different people tell me they spotted them, you know, and they don't seem to look really much like the other creatures. They're not usually as big. They act more like a normal animal than these creatures do. So we do have these animals. I do believe there probably is another small percentage that are misidentifications. I think bear is the one people usually say the most, but I think a bear is more likely to be misidentified between Bigfoot than a dog man, because they both walk, bears and Bigfoot both walk flat-footed. They're bulkier. You know, they've got just bigger, longer arms and things. The dog men are always described as having the dog-shaped, thinner at the ankles and the paws, you know, that the way that they're built, thinner, tapered at the waist. And most people in Wisconsin know what a bear looks like. You know, if you see a bear, you get any good look at him. My dad was from northern Wisconsin. I've spent a lot of time up there, so I've seen bears in the wild and heard them and stuff. And they're really not the same as either one. But I think there are probably chances where people didn't get a great look. Maybe it's dark. They didn't see the head clearly. They couldn't see the feet clearly. You know, and in that case, a misidentification is more likely to be.
So bears travel. I mean, they travel through there like on a migratory route, or because I haven't heard of too many bear. I mean, I'm not from that area. I'm from Oregon. We have a plethora of bears up here, but I didn't know there was many bears out in that area.
Yeah,
yeah. In southern Minnesota, we don't have any bears.
Well, we have. They actually show up just it was a year ago or the year before last. There was one in somebody's backyard in Madison, you know, this, which is our state capital. We had a couple in the suburbs of Milwaukee, and usually somebody sees them in their backyard, and they're either bothering the bird feeder or they get up in a tree and have to get shot down with a tranquilizer dart, you know. But they're all over the evening news. They're not caring if people see them, really. You know, they're not terribly elusive.
Yeah.
But however, I always think if you're seeing one or two, there are going to be more. It's not like that. It is the only one.
Are these
so
populations pushing down from the north? Because I know in Minnesota we have bears and wolves in the north, but we don't have any in the middle or southern. But occasionally they'll see a wolf outside of Minneapolis or something.
Well, there are reports of like big breeding families or anything like that. You don't hear about seeing lots of sows with cubs or wolf packs. But most of the time, what the wildlife experts say is that they're from a northern population where it's young males setting out trying to find their own territory. And they may, you know, they may just sweep through and never come back, or they may decide to keep on going, head down to Kentucky, you know, someplace where there's more tree coverage. So, and it's the same with the mountain lions that we're getting are supposed to be coming from the Black Hills. And again, it's the young males out roving, looking for mate. That's what they say.
Interesting. Yeah, because I know southern Wisconsin is a whole different biome compared to northern Wisconsin.
It is.
It's more of a farms and a rolling prairies and patches of woods. And the Kettle Moraine, I mean, I've looked at it on a map.
Yep.
I haven't spent time in it. That's a pretty long area. It's not very wide, but it's definitely long. You think that that's a big enough place to house some Bigfoots then?
I do, because of the kind of terrain. You have to understand that most people don't know why it's called the Kettle Moraine. I'll try and explain that really quickly, but it makes all the difference with something like Bigfoot, which generally like lots of tree cover and slopes, you know, sloped areas. What these are is courtesy of the last glacier. When it came through, it scooped out these steep bowl-shaped depressions with steep sides, rounded bottoms, and then there are ridges that run along between them. And sometimes there'll be a single ridge system, and you'll find cattle after cattle, you know, along either side of it. And the ridges are called moraines, so therefore you get the name Kettle Moraine. And these kettles just stretch for miles and miles and miles. And they're sort of a wildlife refuge. They're full of deer. They're full of just every kind of mammal and bird you can think of, you know, go down in these, because people generally don't. People in these state parks, except for a few shallow kettles, but most of the trails stick to the ridges or the moraines between them, and then you're looking down at the kettles. But the kettles are kind of treacherous to go into. They have a lot of thickets sometimes. They're wooded. They're just not really conducive to hiking. And I know the soil is very rocky and hard. And I know I've slid quite a few feet down the side of a kettle, you know, on my backside more than once, going down in these things. So you have really, when you count the bottom of each kettle and then the sloping sides, actually more square area than just the ground, normal ground square footage would be, if you follow what I'm saying, you know, because they dip down. And they can get around in these things and have terrific cover and go from kettle to kettle and be fairly assured that, you know, people aren't going to be down there most of the time. And in this park, people are urged to keep to the trails, and most of the time they really do. Horses go through there. There are a few snowmobile trails, a lot of hiking and biking trails. So most of the time people are running around these trails, and there's this vast amount of territory between them that nobody goes into. So it actually turns out to be a pretty good habitat, and they're also very well watered. And if you follow something that was following, say, from the bottom of the southern unit all the way up to the northern tip of the northern unit, will find itself then in close proximity, kind of an entry or gateway, because it goes up to around Lake Winnebago, Fond du Lac, that area. It can get around Lake Winnebago. There's lots of parks and natural areas. And then you're sort of almost at the gateway to northern Wisconsin from there. So you can see how it would find its way down and back up.
Yeah, that's interesting. So, go ahead.
I was going to say, with Wisconsin, though, I mean, I'm not really familiar with Wisconsin, to be honest with you. Like, what can you describe the terrain in different parts of the state? I mean,
sure.
How could something like a dog man or, say, a Bigfoot travel or live in certain areas that are, you know, populated? I mean, some of those areas like Bray Road seem hard to fathom in my mind for something to traverse there or
right.
live there. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, and on Bray Road, really, it's only been a single one. I think that Bray Road is was probably a popular foraging area. I think the foraging areas are different than where they actually might live and you know, rear families and that sort of thing. Because they have a lot, all these farms have livestock, they've got dogs, they've got cornfields, which attract deer, raccoons, and also provide great cover. So, and it bears out because sightings always go up once the cornfields grow tall. And it's like these things can now get around, and occasionally they have to cross roads, and that's often where they're seen. And there's also a lot more roadkill because other things are trying to get across the road, you know, and get hit more. They don't have as great a sight line down the roads with the cornfields, so they're not crossing as safely as they usually do either. So the south, and that's southeastern Wisconsin. And a lot of it is meadow, rolling farmlands, but there's a lot more woods than you would think, and a lot of water, lots of rivers, stream beds. Even Bray Road has a creek that runs through a field and crosses it, and all along this creek there's this little tree cover that something could cross the, and that actually, again, is very close to where a lot of the sightings occur, you know, so it tells you that something's trying to kind of covertly get through this. And again, if it's just a foraging area for a lone animal, especially the dog man that can go on all fours when it wants to, you know, I don't think that that's too much of a problem. I did have recently a sighting of what really sounds more like a Bigfoot on Bray Road, which is the first one almost ever, and the dog man sightings are way down, so I'm wondering if the Bigfoot is winning the territorial war.
Yeah.
You know,
nice.
You know, but also you have to realize too, if you look at the state park that's on the map, there are park boundaries, but the actual Kettle Moraine structures extend out many miles in either direction. For instance, I live myself about 7 or 8 miles south of the southern unit of the Kettle Moraine, but my own neighborhood consists of, the street is actually a ridge that goes between a huge system of kettles. I have a kettle 10 feet from my office window. I'm standing and looking at it right now as I speak, you know. And something, I've observed lots of things around here. And they go right up to the lake system, and then it can get around and up into the Kettle Moraine State Park. So it's not confined to the state park. Now, if it gets over in the western side of the state, it's like a whole different area. You've got an unglaciated area where there are lots of cliffs and huge parks. It's much less developed, much less populated. Bluffs, you've got the Mississippi River coming up that left side of the state, which is another great attractant for all kinds of cryptids. Has some really good big bird sightings along there, by the way. And, of course, that runs up to the forests in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin. So then you've got probably the northern third of Wisconsin is really heavily forested with lots of big rivers, you know, and then, of course, the Great Lakes. You've got Superior up there to the north and Michigan over to the east. So it actually, if you look at it and study it, you can see how not huge populations, but maybe just big enough to be viable populations of both of them could sort of eke their way through, you know, and try and find, you know, new land for their breeding groups.
Yeah, northern Wisconsin makes sense to me. It's the southern part, which I find intriguing. I mean, that whole effigy mound correlation that you made is very compelling as well. The sightings of the dogmen somewhat match the Native American effigy mounds.
They do, and it's not every single sighting, but the hot spots or where there are usually little cluster sightings of two or three. To me, two or three is enough to call it a hot spot because they're unusual, and the fact that two or three get reported in one site means there's probably more from my experience. But what I discovered, and this is outlined in Hunting the American Werewolf, I'm a real fan of Native American history and culture, and there's a great book on the Effigy Mounds of Wisconsin. And for people who are unfamiliar with those, Wisconsin has, this is astounding, and mostly in the southern half of the state, 96% of the world's ancient animal-shaped effigy mounds. That is, mounds that are built up above the surface of the earth in the shape of a recognizable animal of some sort. There are lots of other places that have, you know, cone-shaped mounds, pyramidal mounds, other types. But the animal-shaped effigy mounds are just so unique to this region. And there are some in Iowa and some in Illinois. You know, they don't recognize state extend into these. And, of course, Ohio has the Great Serpent Mound. So there are exceptions. But most of them are in southern Wisconsin. And I was looking at this book, at this map of where different concentrations of types of effigy mounds were. And there was one for what used to be mistakenly called the lizard mound, but would be more accurately called the water spirit mound. They have these long tails, and they're kind of unique looking. And I was thinking, something looks really familiar about this map. And then I realized it was almost exactly the same as my map of hot spots of dogman sightings in southern Wisconsin. And I made transparencies and overlaid them. They lined up almost perfectly. And it was just this eureka moment, like, wow, I don't know what this means, but it's just like too much to be coincidence. And the people who made the effigy mounds are very old. They were already there when the settlers came, and the native people who were living here were not the ones who made them. But it's now generally thought that they were probably made by the ancestors of our present-day Ho-Chunk people. And I had been trying to get an interview with a Ho-Chunk elder. They're very reticent to talk to outsiders about their traditions and culture. And when I called and told the culture chairman what I had figured out, I had an interview with a tribal elder who was an anthropologist, just like that, because they're also very avidly studying and trying to reclaim, you know, the meaning of these mounds for themselves. And, you know, I think we had a very good exchange of information there. So, you know, there's theories that these mounds were, I think the predominant theory is that they were definitely religious symbols, and some people think that there may have been something like guardian spirits embedded in them to watch over these sacred areas. And the theory is then that people come and disturb the mounds, and these spirits are out there. Who knows? And who knows if that's what's causing these sightings or not? Because again, as I said, the great majority of the sightings appear to be flesh and blood, wolf dogs, or, you know, some other type of combination. But again, there are a certain number that just don't fit that. And I really try as a researcher not to just automatically throw out the ones that don't seem convenient to my own hypotheses. You know, maybe there's this 5 or 6%. You know, maybe they are just misidentifications. Maybe they're some other thing. Maybe they're aliens. Who knows what they are? But I feel if I'm really doing my job as a record keeper of these sightings, I need to include them and allow different hypotheses, even though they seem outlandish, to, you know, to different people. Because once they may provide important clues. Who knows? There may be things there that we don't see now that we may see later. You know, and I just feel it's wrong to only include the ones that fit what you believe and judge and leave out the rest. That's my personal operating.
Yeah, I think there's something to be learned from everything.
Yeah. I may not think that they're all the same. And I've often said right from the beginning, too, you know, I do think it's likely that if you take the total aggregate of sightings, that there are probably a number of different things causing them. Some will be misidentifications. Some will be hoaxes. I don't rule those out, and I often like to talk about those because I think as a researcher, you need to be aware of them and admit that they happen, or else you're just going to get snookered, you know, right and left. So you have those things. Some may be otherworldly manifestations that we don't understand. People see ghostly apparitions all the time. They see UFOs. They see all kinds of things that we can't explain. Maybe there's something that's mimicking the flesh and blood upright dogma that is something different that we don't understand. So that's why, you know, people will say, well, you know, yeah, I like your books, but then when you start talking about these other creatures that do this and that, I have to say, well, I just lay it all out and you can decide to accept what you like. And if somebody says, well, every time, you know, they're talking about this, I think that's a misidentification, that people are welcome to make you, you know, about what people think of these. You know, it's up to everybody to make up their own mind.
Yeah, I mean, as an investigator or a researcher, you kind of have to stay in the middle with a lot of these reports and encounters. Otherwise, you know, if you lean a little bit too much to the left, a little bit too much to the right, you kind of lose your focus and you can't really discern what is fact and fictional. You know, you kind of take in a lot from both sides, you know, and I totally agree with you there, you know, and, you know, I'm a researcher myself with Bigfoot and I get a ton of encounters and reports and I really have to kind of stay down the middle. Otherwise, I find myself, you know, falling into a position where I start not really doing research, but, you know, falling into an area where, you know, I could be faulty.
Right. Well, here's the thing. You could think of it this way. Once you start only accepting the ones that conform to your personal beliefs, you've stopped researching and investigating and started just confirming your own biases.
Exactly.
You know, and that's the trap that I personally try to keep my reporter's hat on. You know, and that was how I would always try and find all the sides and let people judge. Because, you know, and also, again, if you shut certain things out, you might miss certain important clues that might not be apparent at that time, you know, but that may fit another pattern later. So, you know, I keep every report. I don't post or publish every report. There are some that, you know, I just keep separately, but they're somewhere in my files, if nothing else.
Is there some reports that you get that are just plain ridiculous? I mean, just way out there that there's no way that, you know, you can fathom them at all?
Well, you know, I mean, a lot of people would say, well, anytime you've got Bigfoot or an upright dogman, that's way out there. So it's just a matter of degree. It's really usually not so much the facts of what's being reported as how it's being reported. Once in a while, I'll get one that's just so sensational, you know, that if it's reading like something out of, you know, one of the werewolf fantasy games, and I've learned to look for certain keywords that tip me off to like the apocalypse werewolf game, you know, things like that. You have to be really aware of what's out there in culture because, again, it's something that, you know, people will try and mislead you now and then. Really not very many. I don't get a lot of those. Most people are better humans than to do that. But once in a while, something comes through where I can just tell they're not just relating something that they observed. They're telling a dramatic, really over-the-top story, or it's something in their attitude, or, you know, you just kind of learn to read them. And there are probably some that still get through. I can't go out and administer polygraph tests to all these people.
Right.
You know, I have to do the best I can, but, there are always a few. And I do know there are hoaxers out there. I will say I think it's a lot harder to hoax an upright dog man than it is a Bigfoot because at least the Bigfoot and human both have knees and walk flat-footed, whereas it's really difficult to pull off a dog leg and walking on digitigrade paws. You know, our legs and feet just aren't made to do that. And people will send me pictures of themselves. There are some people who have really elaborate werewolf-style costumes. You know, they belong to these groups where everybody dresses as animals, and yet you see their feet, and the closest anybody has managed getting the feet is if they're on these kind of springy-looking, they're sort of semi-stilts, they're curved, and they're spring form, so that, I don't know if you know exactly what I'm talking about. I don't know I can't think of the technical name for them. But still, they look big and awkward compared to what a real canine's legs would look like. So it's hard to pull that off. But I know of at least three different hoaxing incidents right on Bray Road. I know that there were a couple of teens who had werewolf masks. I know that there had a bear suit that he was trying to scare away people from parking on his yard. And I know that there was somebody who told me he was actually an elected official living within the county. I won't say of what he was elected, but he for fun, rented a gorilla suit and ran it. So if somebody saw him, they probably would have said they saw Bigfoot. And I never got a report from any one of those. And none of the times I've had any kind of report like that has it correlated with an actual observation that somebody made. So I think most of the time, they're not really fooling anybody, and instead they're putting themselves in danger of getting hit, like that dude in Montana wearing the ghillie suit did last year. Got hit by two cars, or being shot at, like the guy who was the Chocolaco monster down in Missouri, pretty much almost got shot to death. Because people do carry guns around, you know, quite a bit, you never know if somebody's going to take a pot shot. So it's kind of a stupid thing to do. But people still do it, and it's best to be aware and know. The same way as I tell people who want to know, well, what should I look for, you know, if I'm out looking for these things, and I always tell them the first thing you need to do is find out what local wildlife is there, because even as rare as bears or mountain lions or things like that may be in your area, you're still actually probably more likely to see one of those than a dogman. I do think the dogman sightings are more rare than the Bigfoot. I think there are fewer of them. And I'm not sure if that's a people reporting thing or just reflects the numbers of the creatures. It's impossible to say. But if you don't know what the local wildlife is that's supposed to be there, you won't be able to really identify things well. You know, you're setting yourself up for a misidentification. It's much more likely that way. And also you need to know, maybe you should have bear spray with you.
Yeah, definitely. I carry mace with me. Wherever I go out in the woods, it's a tear gas, pepper spray mix.
Yeah. Because there are feral dogs. There's one place I like to go where three pit bulls are quite often released. And I've actually caught one of them raiding my trail cam at night, so I know they're out there. But, yeah, you know, there are feral hogs in a lot. Western Wisconsin has a pretty high feral hog population, and a lot of the southern states do now, too. So, there's
all kinds of
things.
Hogs have made it up, huh?
Oh, yeah. Yep, they're so adaptive, you know, and you won't want to meet a large one of those, you know, face-to-face.
No.
So it really is best, I tell people, think safety first. You know, if you're going to go out looking, which I really generally try to give people a realistic picture of what they're likely to find, which is normally nothing.
Nothing, yeah.
Unfortunately, yeah. I've spent a lot of time in southern Wisconsin. I worked at the Grand Mall in Milwaukee years ago.
Oh, yeah.
I've been to concerts down there at Alpine Valley and just traveled through there quite a bit, and it is a really nice area. I like it.
It is. It is. I enjoy living here. I especially like living near the Kettles and the Kettle Moraine. And I've been walking these ridges and trails around the park and in areas near the park for 19 years. And last year I did actually, well, 20 years almost. Last year I actually did have my own encounter finally. And it's really weird when you've been investigating something for so long and people always want to know if you've seen one, and I've been saying, nope, 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 yep, okay, I've seen one. And it's a whole different experience. And I know the reaction was a little mixed. I saw somebody said on one of the forums, well, yeah, this woman just happens to walk out and all of a sudden she just happens to see one. I'm like, well, yes, but it's been 20 years and it's in an area where I've documented a population. And if I was going to make something up, it would be the Dog Man and not Bigfoot, since that's mostly what I'm known for and write about. You know, it was very, very unexpected.
That's awesome. You want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, it was in one of these kettles, and it was a trail that I've walked a lot and never thought about it. I really thought if there were Bigfoot, they'd be farther north. I hadn't had one right where I was walking. And it was just a last-minute Sunday evening stroll. It was in last year in July. I had no camera with me. I didn't even bring my cell phone. I had nothing. I was just going to go out for this little run and then come back. And I had gone as far as I usually went, was coming back, running down this hill, and I saw these three sapling trees that were bent over to form like a perfect triple arch. And it just caught my eye, and I thought, that's not natural. Because there was nothing else. Usually if there's a big wind, there's a big tree blow where everything's going, you can see other things all going in the same direction. There was nothing else there like that. And I thought, well, you know, maybe it's natural, but maybe it isn't. And I knew that that's something that is often spotted around in Bigfoot territories, not Dogman. They're not noted for any kind of that, you know, woodcrafting stuff. So I went a little farther on down to where there was an opening to kind of a wider ridge. And there were houses dotted here and there, like an acre or two apart. But a lot of them, I know, were weekend homes, and there was nobody around. There's absolutely nobody around. So I thought, well, nobody's going to know if I just walk 10 feet off the trail and bang on a tree just a couple of times, just for fun, which is not something I do. Again, normally, I would never have thought of it. But for some reason, that night I did, and I banged on it a few times. And lo and behold, down in the kettle nearby me, I got a knockback. And it was unmistakable. It was coming from down in the kettle. I knew nobody, no humans were down there. But I know you can't bang on a tree unless you've got an opposable thumb. You know, so I thought, well, if there is by chance somebody down there, I'm going to make them really work for it. So I kept banging the tree. I got a couple more knocks. And I was starting to get really nervous, but I didn't want to stop because I just wanted, I thought, well, I can run back to the trail, and I didn't have too far to go.
What time of year was this?
This was July last year.
Okay.
So everything was very thick and green, I should add. I mean, it was very overgrown. And you couldn't really, anything could have been down in there because the kettle was probably about 30 feet deep, and all of a sudden, after we had exchanged a couple, there was a huge rustling. I could see branches moving in the bottom of it down there. Nothing like a raccoon or something like that would make. It was something very big, moving these big branches, and a rustling sound. And I thought, well, that's interesting. And I hit the tree again because I just didn't really feel threatened. I was nervous and just kind of excited and sort of in disbelief that it could really be anything. And that, at that point, there was a huge, old, tall oak tree growing out of the bottom of the kettle, and it was sort of toward the back of the kettle. So I was probably maybe 100 feet from it, something like that, not really that far. And it had a branch that would have been, because I was standing on the ridge, about at my eye level, but it was probably 30 feet up the tree, and it had lots of green foliage on it. So there was something behind it. I couldn't see what it was, but all of a sudden, that branch split and cracked. And this was we had had no storms. There was not a leaf moving in the entire area. It was perfectly still and calm. The branch cracked off, moved horizontally until it pointed straight at me. And then I was in shock and disbelief. I hit the tree again just because I didn't know what else to do. I mean, it sounds so dumb, you know, but when you're in the middle of a situation like that, you're just not thinking. At least I wasn't. I was just like, duh, what? And there was another sharp crack, and the whole branch was then sheared away from the tree. I could see it was twisted as it went. It wasn't like a natural just, I've seen tree branches just fall, you know, and they crack and they crank down. This was twisted, and the whole thing dropped 30 feet to the floor. And then I decided I needed to leave. I knew what it was because there was no way that a human could have done that. So I left. I started thinking, well, maybe it was weakened by a woodpecker, or maybe somebody had been up there and tried to saw a branch off, although Lord knows why that would be. I can't imagine. This was part of a five-acre tract that somebody was trying to sell, you know. So and it had marshy kettles behind it, you know, that led into this system. I would have been down there trying to saw this one branch off. But I got a couple of a friend of mine who's a trained investigator and lives nearby, and her daughter came over, and we went back there together, and they went down in there with me because it was starting to get kind of late. I sure wasn't going down by myself.
No.
And I just wanted, but I had to know for my own self-knowledge what the deal was, whether the tree was rotten. You know, sometimes they're rotten and they're just ready to go and they topple. So we went down there. There was it was clean, fresh wood. There was lots of green vegetation still on the branch. So the branch wasn't dead. I didn't see any woodpecker holes. There were no saw marks. And in fact, we found near the end of the branch, I've got the measurement somewhere, but as if something really big had leaned over and placed each of its hands, one on either side of the branch, like you would have to do if you were going to twist a branch. You'd have to put a hand on either side and then lurch it, you know, or wrench it. And there were two pieces of bark rubbed away exactly where you would expect that to be. They were about 9 inches long, somewhat mitten-shaped, that were just wrenched off the tree. And there was perfectly clean, fresh wood underneath. You could smell the sap. And in fact, we could smell skunky, musk-like odor just permeating that whole bottom of the kettle. I mean, it was unmistakable. It was just exactly what people describe Bigfoot as smelling like. We found one of the pieces of bark that had just been rubbed off. It was just still lying there. It had fallen off of it. And it was bent in the shape of, if you put your hand flat on a piece of paper and then just kind of scrunched it, keeping your fingers straight, that was exactly what this was shaped like, only it would have had to have been a very huge hand doing it. And it stunk like crazy. I still have it. It still faintly smells like it, actually. So, and I've got, I've kept it in a plastic bag. My friend's daughter had picked it up. People are thinking, why don't you subject it to DNA? My friend's daughter had picked it up and handled it all over before I saw it. She was a skeptic. She totally untrained, didn't know what she was doing. I didn't expect to find anything like that, frankly, and hadn't said, well, if you find any bark pieces, don't touch them, you know, because it was nothing I expected to find. So it was already contaminated.
So you went back that same day?
Yeah, that night. Yeah, like half an hour later.
Wow.
I was back down there. But that isn't the end of the story. So that made us really nervous, and we went up the back ridge of the kettle behind the tree where this had occurred, partly because that was the easiest slope to get down into it. The other slopes were just really too steep. Some of the kettles are just like a drop-off going over a cliff. And two of the sides of this one were like that. So we get up to the ridge, and we're standing there looking around, and my friend's daughter, who's a total neophyte, screams because she saw it. It was just moving into some vegetation in the adjacent kettle, and she got just like a 1 or 2 second impression of it, and it was, she said it was larger than a human. She couldn't see its face, its back was to her, but she said it was moving really fast. It wasn't what you'd call like walking. It wasn't like you'd call it running. She called it striding, which is pretty much a perfect dead-on description. And furthermore, it didn't have, normally if somebody was thinking they saw Bigfoot, you'd think of the dark red or the dark brown color. And this one, she said, was a light beigey, kind of silvery beige color, you know, which is the blonde Bigfoot. And she didn't know there was such a thing. She said, well, that can't be. But she said it was way lighter than the deer that when they first drove past this area, they saw several deer running for their life away from it. And the deer are all sort of a reddish brown around that time. And she said this was much lighter. There's nothing around here that's that color that's large. You know, I mean, I don't know what else it possibly could have been. Well, that wasn't the end of it either. Sandra and I were looking frantically, and we couldn't see it, of course. But then from very close by, it growled at us. And
oh, wow.
It was, and I say that it was it and not a dog. I would have seen a dog or heard a dog. A bear would have made itself known. I've heard bears. This is not a bear growl. This, I've heard mountain lions. I've just spent a lot of time outdoors. Again, my dad being from up north. It was something that only could have been made by a creature that had a huge larynx and big lungs. It was that deep and guttural. It made the hair stand up on our necks, and it was the kind of thing that you suddenly know you're a small mammal, and there's something bigger than you that can get you. You know, it was this primal instinct of like, and I just said, ladies, we have to leave right now. And they agreed. They weren't protesting, and then we got out of there. So if it hadn't been for my friend's daughter's sighting of it, the mitten-shaped bark rubs, the smell, and also the growl. I mean, we had the full, I would say, well, it was just somehow I still can't explain how I would have been directed to go stand and look at that tree just before the branch was about to come down. You know, I mean, if you think it's just, if you say, well, you just had this premonition to go over to that tree and watch the branch come down, that's a whole spooky thing in itself. You know, to me, almost less likely than the Bigfoot. But I've had other correlations. I have found a couple of footprints in that area that were 15 inches in different spots. Both times they were on this rocky slope area that was impossible to cast. I took pictures, but they didn't come out really well, but I've got them. I have found a 9-inch handprint right where you would have to place your hand, again, on a rocky, almost vertical area to kind of climb out of there. That was actually a better print than the footprint. It's really hard soil with a lot of vegetation on top, so it's not a good footprint area.
Any claws associated with these prints?
No, and we went back the next day when it was daylight, and we felt a lot more confident in the morning. And I actually climbed partway up into that tree looking for some kind of scrapings or hair, or, you know, I had magnifying glass with me. And, you know, the rubber gloves and the whole nine yards, and couldn't really find anything like that, except there was kind of a stack of another part of a different oak tree that had been pushed over behind the tree that made a really handy stepping stool. Otherwise, I never could have got up in there. And the bark on the top of that was completely rubbed away, like something large routinely climbed up on it to go up into that tree. And right behind that tree, on that ridge, is a very well-used deer trail. Deer droppings everywhere.
Now, I got a question for you, Linda. I'm not sure if you've been asked this before or not. I haven't heard anything of it. But what about sleeping quarters? You know, with Bigfoot, I get a lot of reports of stick structures and caves and blah, blah. You know, any evidence as to where they sleep or nest at night or rest?
Well, I do think this particular area is probably a foraging area, although I've identified a couple of really unusual structures that, you know, it's really hard to say for sure that they're stick structures, but they sure look like them. They're big enough to accommodate one or two of them sitting in there. Someone suggested that the stick, and to me, wherever I find them, they're located on deer trails. To me, they're more like hunting blinds. Or maybe a place where, you know, a parent and a young could sit. And I have found an 8-inch really wide, what looks like to me is a juvenile footprint there, too. I do think that I have several reasons to believe there may be a juvenile in the area. But, again, I really think it's more of a foraging area and that the actual living quarters would be deep inside the Kettle Moraine State Park, and I have some ideas about where those are too, based on different things, but I don't usually. I don't like to reveal any of these locations because they'll just be swarmed, you know.
Right, but do you feel that they burrow, they sleep in, like, you know, heavy brush, caves, tunnels? I mean, what's your general opinion?
I think they have some kind of really good cover. There could be caves, and you hear about them, you know, anecdotally being in rock shelters, other places, or caves. That could certainly be it. I know there are some places where there's real heavy brush cover inside the park itself, where people can't go, and I'm not sure anybody would know if they were in there. I've identified actually what one likely area, but I couldn't say for sure. I think they're probably really adaptable, and they may even live farther away than that. You know, maybe they have summer stations and secondary. I know that this particular area was used by the Sac and Fox people who lived around the southern Kettle Moraine as a summer camping ground. You know, and maybe the Bigfoot do the same thing. Maybe they go somewhere else in the winter. I don't know. I don't claim to know those kinds of things.
Right.
Yeah, because I know they have hunting in that park. And is there a lot of pines in there, too, or is it mainly deciduous trees?
It's really interesting. Again, it makes it such a unique area. A lot of it, probably most of it's deciduous, but then you'll have these areas where there are just stands and stands and stands of tamarack pines, which give it a whole different ecosystem, you know, and creeks and small lakes and ponds running all through it, too. There are lots of marshes. There's a huge marsh really close to the southern end of the southern unit between Whitewater and Milton where I've had numerous sightings. And, of course, Bigfoot have in many other places been observed harvesting marsh plants of different kinds, you know, especially cattails, and they're digging them up by the roots, you know, and storing the roots and that kind of thing. So, and that's a really hot area around that marsh land.
And you also those other areas by there too, the Lima Marsh Bog.
That's the one. That's the one I'm talking about.
Oh, okay.
About.
And then to the southwest of there is where Katie Zahn, who passed the lie detector and was on Monster Quest, had her encounter, huh?
Right. Yeah, but those were dogmen, and she was
okay.
Real clear. She had really good looks at them, from several points of view, and those were definitely dogmen or upright wolf-like creatures. And yeah, she passed her polygraph with flying colors. And I have to say, I was present for all of those polygraphs. And even there were a couple of people that the producers were sure were gonna trip them up. And every single one passed with completely flying colors. And the guy they brought in to conduct the polygraph test was an expert from Minnesota. That was somebody that police departments and sheriff's departments would bring in when they wanted the top-notch expert. You know, this wasn't just, some flunky or a producer doing the test. They had a real expert. The thing that people have to, again, remember, though, on that show, and you wouldn't know this, but what he asked them was not, did you see a dogman or a Bigfoot, but did you see an upright, hairy creature? And that's how, you know, people would answer to that rather than saying specifically what they saw. That's how they kind of got by with passing them all off as dogmen on the show. And even the animation that they drew was sort of a combination Bigfoot dogman. It didn't really look like either one of them. So, not to get off the subject, but the area where Katie Zahn saw it, again, is a very huge, it's called Avon Bottoms. And, there have been other sightings there. Also lots of big, there's a big electrical grid that runs through there with towers. And actually, something I'm noticing more and more is that there seems to be an affinity between electrical stations and big power lines and both Dogman and Bigfoot sightings. I don't know what the connection is. I don't pretend to, but... there's a lot, and UFOs, you know, in the same vein, all seem to often have connections to these power lines, and one does run through Avon Bottoms.
The power
kind
line,
of wild.
Thing, yeah. Well,
pardon?
Go ahead. Go ahead. No. Finish.
I was just going to say it is a very wild territory, though, with a lot of game too.
I was just going to point out that a lot of the Bigfoot sightings are along power lines as well. And
right.
I've heard some interesting theories on that. One was I think Cliff Brockman had said that because of the heavy, thick brush, the sun does not penetrate through the trees, and so deer and whatnot cannot feed on any grass because there's not really a lot grown in there. But during where the clear cuts are and the power lines, the grass, the sun does penetrate and the grass grows there. And so you find a lot of Bigfoot sightings along
yeah.
the edges of these power lines because there is a abundance of grass grown because of the sunlight penetrating.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And also, these creatures aren't stupid. If you know, they probably don't enjoy and they could run nicely along a cleared off power track if they want to get somewhere fast, you know, and they think
right.
there aren't people around, you know. And I wasn't looking for this for a long time, but when I think back, there was a real well-known Bigfoot sighting outside of Granton, which is kind of in northwestern Wisconsin. And I was able to, his name was Jim Hughes, and it was known that he said that it was carrying a chunk of meat about the size of a goat, and so the headlines all said Bigfoot carrying goat. But he told me that it really wasn't. And I interviewed him in the spot where he saw it. He took me out to this field, and there was an electrical station really not very far from the field where he saw it standing when he was delivering early morning newspapers. And there also was an electrical station very close to the spot where the man down along the Mississippi in La Crosse saw a furry humanoid with bat wings come at his truck. I call it the man bat, a few years ago. So I wish that I had been onto that from the very beginning, but it is something that I notice more and more. And there probably are multiple reasons. You know, some people say, oh, they're feeding off the electromagnetic energy. I don't rule that out entirely either, but it's almost every time you come up with an explanation like that, there's also a very mundane explanation, such as the grass growing there, ease of getting around, and then you're kind of stuck with, well, which one is it?
Yeah, it's true. Well, it looks like we got a caller here. Let's open up the lines here.
There also was a
951, you're on the air.
The man down along the Mississippi in La Crosse saw a furry humanoid with bat wings, the man's truck, I call it the man bat, a few years ago. So I wish that I had been onto that from the very beginning, but it is something that I notice more and more, and there probably are more.
Oh, hello?
Some people say, oh, they're feeding off the electromagnetic energy.
Sounds like starting somebody else.
Hello, 951.
I think somebody's got the radio.
Yeah, you can turn down your
hearing the delay.
Radio, you can talk to us.
They can call back. They can call back. Linda, I do have a question for you, though. What is the largest size dog men report that you've ever taken in? And the smallest size dog men report that you've ever taken in?
They generally range from between 5 to 7 feet. Most people will say about 6 feet. But it is not unusual to have one reported at 7. I don't know if I ever had one, maybe one or two, where they estimated it at 8. And, of course, these are guesstimates, too. A lot of type of creatures moving. You know, it's people's best estimates. Generally between 5 and 7 feet, although I do have some cases of the shorties, I call them, where people have seen what sound like pup-size creatures, around maybe 3 feet tall, running up right across the road. In one case, there was a normal-sized one and then a couple that looked like pups all running across a road down in Kentucky.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Well, let's see here. Here they are again. Let's see if we can get them on. 951, you're on the air.
Hey, I'm just calling in to listen.
Okay.
I don't know if it's near the show or what.
All right, he sounds good.
Linda, what about, like, do you have any estimate on, like, a population size or anything of that nature? You know, it's really hard to guesstimate population size, especially, you know, I get that all the time with Bigfoot. You know, how many Bigfoot could there possibly be, you know,
right.
around? Any population size or guesstimation there?
You
or,
know, I don't even hazard a guess. The best I can say is that there do seem to be small family groups because people will occasionally see two, three, four, even that scene that's in my latest book where the woman and her husband saw five upright wolfmen flanking them. And they're two of the most credible witnesses I've ever interviewed and investigated. So other than saying they seem to have small family units, I just wouldn't even have any way of estimating. So, you know, to me it's astounding that there's one, but we know there are a lot more because, and a lot of people will still call it the Beast of Bray Road, like there's one creature and it's been there forever. And I'm like, well, if there's one creature, it has the ability to be in several places at once and create clones of itself, and it's, you know, many, many decades old because these things have been reported for a long time all over the country and even the world.
Right.
You know, now, what do you think they are? Do you think they're just some sort of canine that hasn't been discovered yet or wolf misidentification or?
My best guess, if they're flesh and blood creatures, and again, I go by the reports that I get. And again, in well over 90% of the cases, probably more than that, they seem like flesh and blood creatures. But they're normally, their colors are the same as you would expect in any wolf pack, although a lot of the time they're dark brown or nearly black, which tells me they might have more dog in them than wolf. And actually that's been found to be the case recently by scientists who've mapped out the wolf genome, where you have dark brown wolves, they have a more recent reintroduction of canine genetic material. So there is a little more to that. I would say if that's the case, I think they're more like not a new breed or new species or anything like that, but especially adapted because the one difference is that they seem to have elongated paws. And this is something that could be a genetic trait that was passed on and would also be the very thing that would make it much more easy for a quadruped to suddenly begin walking upright. If you've got bigger hind feet, you can balance much more easily. So to me, it would just be something that had undergone an adaptation, maybe had also gotten a little bit more intelligence. And again, that would be a trait that could be passed on by using the forelimbs in ways that they weren't normally intended to be used. For instance, holding, many people have observed them carrying away a haunch of venison or holding up a piece of roadkill in its upturned paws. So anytime you've got a new kind of activity going on, it, you know, makes you a little smarter. And maybe a combination of genetically adapted creatures combined with learned skills. It's also been shown that wolf parents teach the pups hunting skills and different tricks. A lot of what they do is learned behavior, not just instinct. So I don't think that it has to be a new type of species or anything like that.
What do you think? I got two questions for you. One was mentioned in the chat room is, do they have a tail like a dog? And, you can answer that one, and I'll ask you the next question.
Yeah, when people get a look at a tail, they describe it as more of like a wolf-like tail, usually, not the skinny type, but like a brushy wolf-like tail is what they describe when they are able to see one.
And what about, have you delved into or got any, encounter reports of, like, the chupacabra? I know recently there was one out in Mississippi of supposed what the guy called a chupacabra being killed out in Mississippi. You know, what are your thoughts on the chupacabra or these weird, almost mange-looking coyote wolf hybrid dogs being killed? There's been
a couple.
I've
actually recently done quite a bit of research on this, and I even interviewed Dr. Phyllis Canyon in Texas. She's the woman who had been collecting the specimens after three or four of them were killed right around her ranch, and she had the dead specimen in her freezer and sent the head in to be tested. And it actually tested out as mostly coyote and Mexican wolf, but with another additional something that really couldn't be identified. It's almost like they're like those things. They're not anything like what people in Puerto Rico were describing in those chupacabras attacks.
Yeah.
You know,
they're very different.
Yeah, they're very, and yet there's actual footage of these Texas, they call them Texas blue dogs now.
Yes.
Which is probably a little bit more accurate. If you see the footage of these things running, it's scary. They're weird looking. They've got these long kind of pointy snouts. They have this unusual feature of on their rear end, on either side, kind of roughly where most dogs would have anal glands, except these are outside and they're not squishy glands. They're sort of like meaty pouches on either side of their hind ends. And one of them's running and you can see it real well. And Dr. Canyon has a stuffed mounted entire specimen in her house that she shared some photographs with me of them. And they're really bizarre creatures, but there's no evidence that they are chupacabras, and nobody has, you know, they don't have like the hollow fangs or any of the features that the goat, so-called goat sucker, you know, in Puerto Rico was supposed to have had. Spines
right.
on the back, it doesn't have that. You know, those creatures in Puerto Rico were sometimes bipedal. They had a very different, they were smaller. They had a very different structure to them. So I think that you're talking about two different things. The interesting thing about those Texas blue dogs, though, was that there have been a lot of creatures that are like coyotes or raccoons that were mange covered that made them hairless. These animals did not have mange. They were tested for it, did not have it. And, in fact, they had a fine fuzz over their body. They weren't all, if you've ever seen an animal with mange, it's a really uncomfortable sort of condition to have, and it'll be all bleeding and scratched and red and pink on its exposed skin where the animal's trying to, you know, get some relief and itch it. These animals didn't have anything like that. They were more like the Texas or the Mexican hairless breed, and yet that didn't show up.
Do you think that there's some sort of hybrid or you know, a mix between a wolf and a coyote? Because the one video I saw, I think a sheriff took in Texas, it moved like a coyote. But, you know, some of the video and pictures I've seen, they do have a blue skin, and they don't look like anything that has mange. I've seen animals with mange before.
Exactly.
They don't look like that. Yeah.
No, they don't. They didn't. I mean, it was lab tested, and they did not find the mange mite that causes sarcoptic mange. The thing is, they did have coyote ancestry. They did have Mexican wolf ancestry. And what people don't realize is that the gene for hairlessness is a dominant gene. And sometimes it can occur spontaneously. And I guess it actually occurs more often spontaneously than people realize. It's not completely unheard of. And I've actually wondered if perhaps a coyote and a Mexican wolf at some point back when got together and had a spontaneous hairless hybrid pop up that was different in origin than the Texas blue dogs or the Mexican, than the Mexican hairless dog. Because the Mexican hairless dog's DNA didn't show up. It was something different. So maybe this is a completely different new hybrid that they're seeing. I don't know. That's pure speculation on my part, but it was the best thing I was able to come up with after looking at all the facts and kind of reading up on the genetics of the hairlessness, which is interesting, very interesting reading.
Yeah, that's a good analysis. Well, looks like we got time for one call here. 435, you're on the air.
Hey, what's happening? Hey, this
hey.
Is Art down here in the
Hello.
Room. But anyway, I think Linda's been a really great guest. I was wondering if she's had any
Thank you.
Reports of any sightings from Utah.
I have. The ones from Utah
Uh-oh.
Tend to be a little closer to what I think of as the skinwalker variety, and that's
yeah.
what the people are perceiving them as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're not like the upright canids of the eastern forest. They're in that other 5%.
That's,
but
yeah,
I do get upright
wild.
Canines. Yeah.
Yeah. I love the stories of the Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, from Utah, I also have gotten reports of some kind of type prints that don't seem to make any sense.
Yeah. It's kind of like Arizona or New Mexico in a way. It's a strange area. I don't understand
right.
it completely, but yeah.
Right. They're sort of cylindrical. They're really odd. So I don't know what's going on there.
Yeah. Cryptids.
Yep, exactly. Never figured about it.
Yeah, I've heard a lot about the Skinwalker Ranch. It's probably an hour and a half or 2 hours away from where I am now, but
wow,
it's really wild. Some of those stories are just out of this world. It fits right in with all the cryptid stuff. You know, the Skinwalker Ranch
yeah.
and all that.
Yeah, that's an amazing story. Yeah, I have that book and would love to get down there one of these days. Although I realize it's not open to. Just anybody going there anymore, but yeah, that seems to be a whole different range of phenomena, and I don't know if the regular upright canids are related to it or not. It's hard to say. It's one reason that I don't discount any sighting, because I'm hoping someday I'll see a pattern and how they interact and overlap, and if they do have anything to do with one another, you know, maybe eventually if we get enough sightings, we can start to figure some of those things out.
Yeah, really.
Hey, Linda. I was going to say, we don't have much time left, so I'd like to know anything on the horizon for you, any more books coming out, any TV shows, what have you got planned for your, you know, the future that we can look forward to?
Yeah, I recently filmed an episode of the Monsters and Mysteries show. Look for that around all midwinter, something like that. There's a sci-fi's Haunted Highways episode that's coming up that I don't think is shown yet that will show a lot of Bray Road stuff that should be really fun. I've got a new book coming out in early 2014. I can't give the title of it yet, but it's got a lot of really interesting stuff.
Where is the best place to find your books?
They're on all the online sites. Barnes & Noble has them, Amazon. You can go to lindagodfrey.com, and I've got a books and bio page where you can get clickable links to all of my books if you can't find them on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or somewhere else.
Very nice. Yeah, I got mine on eBay.
Great. Yeah, some of them are still floating around on there. Beast of Bray Road is out of print, but unfortunately. But sometimes you can find an old copy, but they're a little bit pricey.
Yeah, I look forward to your shows coming up. It sounds very exciting. Well, thanks,
Thank
everyone,
you.
For joining us. Thanks, Art,
yeah.
for calling in.
Yeah, you bet. Great show, guys. I'll hang up now.
Thanks, buddy.
Thanks. Thanks so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
Yes, thank you, Linda. We'll have to have you back, and I
sure.
hope to be able to get out to Wisconsin myself and do some research either later this fall or next year.
Well, let me know when you decide you're coming, and if I'm around, we'll have to take you out a few places.
Yeah, sounds great.
Okay.
Excellent.
And
well, thank you,
everyone
Linda.
Else.
Have a great fall.
Yeah, you too.
Thank you. You guys take care.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, thanks everyone in the chat room. Bama. He puts on a good show as well. His is Friday nights, Southern Sasquatch Society. It airs at 11 Eastern, 10 Central. And Beth and all the guests and Moody and Ramble and Randy, Russ, Stefan, Wild Eye, Wild Heart, and Crystal, and some of the other people that were on earlier. And we will see you next week for another episode of Monster X Radio.